It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In just a few moments, we'll take a look at why studying ancestry, why genealogy has become such a hot industry in the United States. First, though, we're continuing our week-long series on elder care in Wisconsin.
The number of Wisconsin prison inmates over the age of 65 is on the rise, and it's increasingly becoming a challenge to provide them with adequate health care. Gilman Halstead has this report.
In the past year in Wisconsin, 24 terminally ill inmates have died in the prison hospice at Dodge Correctional Institution. But prisoners who have families that can support them are sometimes released to nursing homes. Linda Pischke says the facility she works in has cared for three such inmates recently. They suffered from end-stage kidney disease, dementia, and multiple sclerosis.
I think the main reason they were released was because of the complexity of their problems, possibly overcrowding in the infirmary where they were taken care of.
All three of them died in the nursing home, but had the opportunity to have visits from their families in their final days. But Pischke says the state won't place some dying inmates in nursing homes because they're registered sex offenders. Her facility is less than 2,000 feet from a daycare center.
So even though that sounds kind of ridiculous because they're not mobile at all anymore, that's the reality of it. And a majority of these people that are being released have sex offense records, and they're having a lot of trouble finding places for them.
In 2013, the DOC reported housing 900 inmates over the age of 60. The medical director in the Department of Corrections, James Greer, says that number is growing, due in part to longer sentences that have resulted from truth in sentencing policies.
What's that 900 number of 60 and over? Is it going to be 1,100? Is it going to be 1,200 in 5 years? And if so, how are we going to manage those in a correctional setting and keep them safe?
One former inmate, now in his late 60s, says the DOC should do a better job of caring for older inmates. Doug, who asked that we only use his first name, is 69. He was released last year after spending all but 11 years of his adult life in and out of prison for crimes ranging from burglary to sexual assault. He didn't live a healthy lifestyle outside of prison, and his ailments, ranging from a collapsed lung to a torn ligament in his knee, got worse while he was locked up.
It's only been since I've got out that people are actually trying to help me with my medical problems, but inside, no.
Doug's getting help now at the Veterans Hospital to address a long list of health problems. 55-year-old Joseph Fry was also released last year. He has similar complaints about the care he got for his degenerative disc disease during his two stints in prison. He says prison officials postponed surgery for him until it was almost too late.
It wasn't until I sprawled out on the floor and had them released all my bowels and everything because it went out. And so they did the surgery, finally. The treatments I've gone through in the past 8 months has actually been more beneficial than all the time I was in the DOC.
Fry is getting the care he needs now, thanks to assistance from the Wisconsin Innocence Project. The last 8 years he spent in prison were for a crime he didn't commit. The state is considering building a new facility or refurbishing an existing one to better care for aging inmates with serious illnesses, but officials say they're not ready to discuss where or when that might be. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That was the second in our week-long series on aging and elder care in Wisconsin. Tomorrow at this time, we'll take a look at some of the jobs elder care is creating, particularly with the rise of in-home care.
First, these days it can seem like ancestry buffs are everywhere. Even if you're not into genealogy yourself, you probably know somebody who is. Someone who can tell you about all the cool people they're related to and the names of far-off towns their ancestors came from.
Well, and now there's this whole internet, and genealogy has become even more of a craze with sites like Ancestry.com that help research and connect with possible members of our families. Something that used to be a tradition of European nobles is now available for a monthly fee online. Here to talk about genealogy is writer and literary critic Maud Newton. She's got a new piece in Harper's Magazine. It is titled America's Ancestry Craze, Making Sense of Our Family Tree Obsession. Maud, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, you dug into your family lineage, and we'll get into that in a bit. But what is driving people to check out their family trees more and more these days?
Well, as you've said, it's a subject that millions of Americans are passionate about, and it's a growing industry. And I think it really exists in this hazy realm between fact and superstition, We're looking for the facts about our ancestors, but even as we do, we're hoping to understand ourselves.
And you write that this used to be a way for a Greek ruler or a pharaoh to trace their descent back to a god or goddess or royalty to establish the claims. How has it gotten so democratized over the years?
Well, that's right. In the past, it was definitely something that was reserved for nobles, for royalty. Slowly, it trickled into the middle class, very, very slowly. And then during this century, there's been an explosion of interest, in part, I think, because of things like Alex Haley's Roots, which was just such an important story for Americans, but also because now sites like Ancestry.com, as you say, and sites like 23andMe, which now join traditional ancestry research with DNA research, are available to Americans for a very small amount of money, and people can research these things now from their own home.
And you wrote something I wasn't aware of. There's almost a social media element coming in where, with both parties' consent, as you find a third or sixth cousin, you can reach out and maybe make contact with them and compare notes.
That's right. I've corresponded with a number of my relatives, and in some cases we've been able to identify exactly how we're related to each other. Our trees just hook up, and we know that our research is correct going back to that point, and so we know exactly how we are, for example, third cousins once removed. In my own research, one of the most sort of sad and to me important things has been trying to figure out how I'm related to some of my matches, some of my cousins who are predominantly African American. And because my genome only contains 0.1% North African DNA, I know that it's highly likely that I'm related to these cousins because my ancestors owned theirs.
And the topic of race comes up again and again in the piece you wrote. Let's start with your father, who you describe as racist, not like gray area racism, but overtly racist. How did thinking about the way he thought of your family's heritage, genetic and otherwise, affect you as you started to research your family tree?
Well, to be honest, I think that it's one of the reasons I started researching. I never understood why he felt the way that he did, and I think that in researching my family history, I wondered if I would find some sort of, if not exactly an answer, if my research would sort of shed light on that. And it really hasn't, to be honest. But, you know, as you say, his ideas were just so outrageous. I mean, he literally believed that slavery was a benevolent institution that should never have been disbanded.
And you also write that trying to track family heritage among African Americans was important after the Civil War, trying to reconnect families that had been split for, in some cases, generations by slavery, up to Alex Haley's roots and the effort to find those roots. How important has genealogy and trying to track family history been for African Americans?
Well, obviously, I can't speak to that, not being an African American myself, except as someone who's corresponded with relatives and read a lot about it. And my sense is that it's been incredibly sad for people to have no idea exactly what their heritage is. And what I've discovered, and it's not a surprise, we hear about it in the history books, but what I've discovered as I've researched is that people are listed in the census, you know, in the middle of the 1800s, they're listed on quote unquote slave schedules. They're not even listed as as people with names. They're listed by sex and by gender. And as I write in the piece for Harper's, that was just a terrible thing to encounter. And one thing I didn't get into in the piece is that I've actually found what purports to be a transcription of the will of one of my ancestors, not the one I talk about there, in which he bequeathed his property, including the people he owned, as though those people were just any other kind of property.
Well, and obviously that the documents may not be there. Are people getting excited about the opportunities presented by genetic testing and the sorts of things that I think it's Henry Louis Gates is doing on TV?
Absolutely. I think that Dr. Gates has a really optimistic view of where this can lead us, that it can show exactly how we're all related and how interconnected we all ultimately are. And his show is often so profound. The episode in particular about John Lewis, the senator, in which he discovers, you know, he marched with Martin Luther King, you know, during the civil rights era and fought for voting rights and many other things. And he discovered that his ancestors were among the first African Americans to vote in Georgia before that right was rescinded.
We're talking to Maude Newton about why genealogy is popular, ever more popular, it seems like, in the United States, and what it tells us about ourselves, that we're interested in it, and what we learn from doing it. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you done this? Have you researched your family tree? What did you find out? Have you met other people, maybe cousins down the line, doing the same thing and compared notes? Why do we do it? What's interesting about it, and what does it mean to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back talking about genealogy with Maude Newton. She wrote a new piece on the topic in the June issue of Harper's Magazine, about partly about why we're interested in it and how people do it, and also about what it tells us about ourselves. You can join in. Are you a genealogist? Have you tried to track the family tree? Who have you met along the way, either, you know, current relatives out there that you've compared notes with, or your ancestors long gone? What have you learned about them? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Maude, before we get to our callers, we talked about your father's side of the family a little bit. You found some interesting things on your mother's side, too.
Oh, absolutely. My mother is just such an amazing storyteller, and her family is so idiosyncratic. Some people might say that's a kind word for it. Her father was married 13 times, I'm told, and I've verified 6 of those marriages. His father killed a man with a hay hook, and I discovered that he was actually the sympathetic person in that encounter. And then my mother's 8th great-grandmother and my 9th great-grandmother was accused of being a witch in Massachusetts and beat the charges. And that really interested me because my mother was extremely religious herself, to the point of starting a church. And I discovered that she has a history of female preachers in her family. So there's a wealth of riches on her side for sure.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Julie starting us off in Manitowoc. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call because I have a great interest in my own genealogy, and I made sure that I talked to my grandmother, who was from Hungary, before she died. She lived there until she was 15. So she was there during World War One, and she told me the name of this little village that she was from when it was in Hungary, and then the name changed when it became part of Yugoslavia, so I wrote that down. And it eventually became part of it's in Croatia right now. Mm-hmm. So last year I went onto Wikipedia and I found the little village. It has a population of about 900 today. And my family and I are actually going to go there.
Really?
Soon. Yes. We have this big trip to Europe planned.
How wonderful.
Then enjoy the trip, Julie, and thank you so much for sharing that story. Maud, is this where the addiction of genealogy leads to sometimes, actually going back and visiting the old country, whichever one it might be?
Absolutely. I didn't get into this in the article for Harper's, but actually my therapist has gone back to Poland where his parents lived before the Holocaust, mm. and he has gone back and met some distant cousins with whom he's traveled there. He's not a genealogy person so much, but some of his cousins are, and so he was able to look at records and whatnot and visit these places that were very important to him. And my friend Emily Rabiteau wrote a wonderful book called Searching for Zion. Her own grandfather was actually, she's African American on her father's side, and her own grandfather was killed in Mississippi in the middle of the 1900s, and she went to Africa searching for some sort of a sense of identity that she never felt she'd had before then.
Julie, thank you so much for the call. We'll go now to Sherry with us in Milwaukee. Sherry, hi.
Yeah, hi. My family is very big into this. I'm African American, and we have a family reunion every year. And it's really big, I think, among a lot of African Americans. My aunt is addicted, definitely, to this. She has everything. She has birth records, death records. We go back to my great-great-grandfather, and she recently found his pension papers from after the Civil War, where he was a band servant to his master. And, you know, it's one of the things about it, especially for African Americans, when you look at genealogy, you know, we are intricately linked racially in the United States with, you know, the white Southerners. I mean, it's not just, it's the ownership, of course, of slavery, but it's also a blood relationship. And so seeing it in context, like I can't go back farther than my great-great-grandfather, but the feeling that this is where we are from is very much when you look at that genealogy. You know what I mean?
Sure. And Sherry, we were talking earlier about genetic testing to try to get back, have some idea of roots, origins further back than the documents can show us. Have you done that or thought about doing that?
You know, I'm certain my aunt has thought about doing that because she is probably, you know, ready to do that. But it's definitely something I would consider doing. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm certain I will find on both sides is that there's a significant amount of European blood and there's a significant amount of African blood. And that in some sense makes, in my mind, African Americans who are slave families kind of a new version of people who really come about here in the United States. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Sherry, thank you so much for sharing your family story and your thoughts. Maud, what's your response?
I think that everything that Sherry says is so true. And this interconnection, this relatedness is so powerful. It's so sad, and it's also at the same time the reality. And I think that DNA can uncover some of these mysteries, and a number of geneticists believe that eventually we will have geneticists who have an interest in this sort of thing believe that eventually we will have something called a universal genetic family tree, which will show exactly how everyone on Earth now is related to everyone else on Earth. And, you know, I don't know how soon that will happen or if it will happen. And there are major privacy concerns with entering DNA into these databases. But at the same time, it has been really powerful for me to meet online some of these cousins and to learn about their own research and to try in cases where we have common surnames to figure out exactly where our link is. I haven't been successful in any cases so far, but I'm really interested in pursuing that.
Well, Maude, good luck in making those connections, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with writer and literary critic Maude Newton. Her article, America's Ancestry Craze, Making Sense of Our Family Tree Obsession, is in July's issue of Harper's Magazine.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk with a guest who says the local food movement is failing to protect the workers it so heavily relies on. And she says that needs to change if we want to support ethical eating.
First, it's primary day for a handful of states throughout the country. Voters in Kentucky, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arkansas, Idaho, and Oregon are taking to the polls. And the results will set the stage for some of the big races this November.
A handful of closely watched House, Senate, and gubernatorial primaries are at stake, with results offering clues to the direction of the November election and a look at the future of the Republican Party.
Joining us now with a look at what to watch for today is Steve Shepard, campaigns and elections editor for Politico. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off in Kentucky, where Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell faces a Tea Party primary challenger. What are you watching for here?
Well, mostly we're watching for Mitch McConnell's margin of victory. Tea Party challenger Matt Bevin's campaign has largely fizzled out. Mitch McConnell has been very, very aggressive. He spent roughly $10 million on this primary of his vast war chest, and he still has in the high single digits, very likely remaining in his bank account for the general election. Most polls show him leading by around 20 points, so that we'll have to see his margin. He needs to unify. In Republican-leaning Kentucky, he needs to unify GOP voters in order to win in the general election against Alison Lundergan Grimes, the Democrat who's going to have money to go basically toe-to-toe with McConnell come the general.
So 20 points seems like a pretty generous lead there. If he does prevail, as it looks as if he will, is it kind of a no-brainer that the Tea Party supporters will come to his banner?
Well, Mitch McConnell's been in Kentucky for a long time, and his personal approval ratings and favorability ratings are not very good. He's not very well liked. Most polls show, while he's up by 20 points among likely Republican primary voters, when it comes to the general election, he's at best in a tied race with Alison Lundergan Grimes. So he does have his work cut out for him in the general, but for tonight, it's largely about his margin and to what extent he's able to consolidate that Tea Party support tonight.
And so you're going to draw lessons based on how big the margin is.
That's what I'm looking at right now, and that's going to, I think, give us our biggest clues about the extent to which Democrats can be competitive come November in Kentucky, which is not usually a state in which they're very competitive in federal elections.
So what would be a number that would give you some pause and say it's looking pretty competitive?
I think if he wins somewhere between 55 to 60% of the vote, and Matt Bevin gets into the 40s, then you can look and say that there's a really sizable percentage of Republican primary voters who want someone other than Mitch McConnell to be senator come next year.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to Georgia. It looks like heading toward a runoff there. Who's looking strongest?
That's correct. If no candidate earns 50% plus one of the vote tonight, there will be a runoff in July. Right now, the strongest candidates are self-funding businessman David Perdue and Congressman Jack Kingston. They are the two most likely to make the runoff. A close third, though, is former Secretary of State Karen Handel. She's been supported by Sarah Palin and some conservative Tea Party-leaning groups. She has a chance to make the runoff. There are two congressmen who are a little bit lesser known who are likely to finish fourth and fifth right now, Congressman Paul Brown and Congressman Phil Gingrey. The interesting thing here is that for months, Republicans were very worried that either Brown or Gingrey would get into the two-way runoff and consolidate the conservative Tea Party vote. Both of them have a history of making some controversial comments, and with Michelle Nunn, the Democrat, daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn, so well-funded for the general, Republicans were worried that even though Georgia is another Republican-leaning seat, that they could have their work cut out for them if the nominee was someone that they didn't, you know, the establishment didn't really want. In this case, though, with Perdue has a lot of money, his own money. He's a former CEO of some big companies, including Dollar General. Jack Kingston is the choice of business. He's been endorsed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he's the best outside fundraiser in the race. So if you've got those two candidates in the runoff, Republicans who are worried about potentially losing the seat, they're going to feel really heartened that one of the nominees that they want is going to advance to the general election.
To what extent are you looking at all the results in these primaries and trying to gauge the strength of the Tea Party?
Well, there's another primary that we're really watching here, and that is in Idaho's 2nd Congressional District. Representative Mike Simpson is running for re-election. He's a friend and ally of Speaker John Boehner, which means he's drawn the ire of a lot of Tea Party groups who aren't happy that with the way Boehner's led the House and some of the votes that he's forced House Republicans to take that have in which he's passed bills like bills ending the government shutdown with a minority of Republican support. The Club for Growth, a conservative-leaning outside group, spent big for Simpson's opponent, an attorney by the name of Brian Smith. That spending, though, ended in late April as groups like the Chamber of Commerce came in for Simpson big, including a very expensive TV ad they aired featuring an endorsement on video from Mitt Romney for Mike Simpson. That's another race in which it appears there's very little polling in this Idaho House race, I would caution. But it appears, based on the spending trends, that the establishment has successfully beat back the conservative outside groups, the Tea Party groups. But obviously we'll have to see how the election results pan out because, like I said, there's not a lot of polling.
And there is a pretty, I guess, interesting is a mild word, gubernatorial primary in Idaho as well with some really interesting figures. This went viral. Some people said it ran like something out of Saturday Night Live. What happened?
Well, so Butch Otter is facing a primary challenge. He has one challenger who's a state legislator, and then two challengers who I would say a generous term would be a little bit more eccentric. If you haven't seen the video, I recommend checking it out. They provided a lot of comic relief to the debate. They sort of belie the Butch Otter did not run up a huge margin in his last primary victory in 2010, and he's faced some criticism from Republicans in the state for deciding to set up their own state health insurance exchange. Some Republicans regard that as acquiescing or participating in Obamacare, which is anathema to a lot of what they believe in. But he ran a TV ad defending that to Republicans, saying that we were going to do this the Idaho way, not let the federal government take over. He's hoping that is going to be an argument that carries the day. And like I said, if you have not seen the video of this debate last week, I seriously recommend checking it out.
And let's see, in Oregon, let's go there next. We've got a Republican primary that for weeks sort of looked like a lock for a candidate named Monica Wiebe. And now that seems as though it could be a little bit in question. Catch us up there.
That's true. So in recent days, both Democratic groups and both my news organization, Politico, and also the Portland Oregonian, discovered some old police reports dealing with Monica Wiebe, who's a pediatric neurosurgeon. Republicans were really, really excited about her candidacy. Even though Oregon is a Democratic-leaning state, they felt she had a very unique biography and could potentially put Senator Jeff Merkley's seat in play. But in recent days, there two police reports have been unearthed. Charges were filed in neither case, but in one, an ex-boyfriend accused Monica Wiebe of entering his home and basically stalking him. In another police report from divorce proceedings with Monica Wiebe's ex-husband, he accused her of harassment and other mild violence towards him. The one catch here is that Oregon votes entirely by mail, and a good chunk of the votes had already been received by the Secretary of State's office before the first of these stories even broke. So it's unclear to what extent they're going to have an impact on the actual election returns.
So it's possible that this is a scandal, if you will, that broke too late to make a difference.
Potentially, though, the fact that, Democrats have become a little bit concerned about Monica Wiebe's chances of putting the seat in play. They claim outwardly that Jeff Merkley is still well positioned for re-election, but she does have a compelling biography. She has run some very, very good TV ads that involve parents talking about how she saved their child's life. They're very, very compelling. And, Republicans do think that if she can emerge from tonight's primary, that she has a chance to put the seat in play, particularly if the national environment remains favorable. And also, there's one other factor. In Oregon, the state had a very hard time setting up its health insurance exchange, so Republicans expect the health care law to be less popular there than it is nationally.
Steve, as you watch the returns from these primaries tonight, what are the big questions that you're hoping they might, if not answer, at least sort of hint at a direction?
Well, we're seeing, like we talked about in Georgia and Kentucky and the Idaho House race, the potential for the results to confirm that the establishment has successfully beat back some of these insurgent Republican groups. So look at Mitch McConnell's margin of victory. Look at which two Republicans, if it's Jack Kingston and David Perdue, who advance to the Georgia runoff, that will be a good sign for establishment Republicans, and if Mike Simpson wins re-election. Beyond that, if Republicans hope they can get the candidate they want in the Oregon Senate race, that will bode better for their chances of winning the Senate back, as will getting the right candidates in Georgia, or the right candidates as viewed by some groups. The other thing I'm also looking at is the Pennsylvania governor's race. We didn't talk about this, but there's a Democratic primary to take on Republican Governor Tom Corbett. Corbett is basically the most unpopular Republican governor or governor of all together in the country, and the most vulnerable governor in the country. Democrats are excited about a self-funder by the name of Tom Wolf, who spent $10 million of his own money and has a pretty substantial lead in the polls leading up to the primary. The primary turned a little negative late, so we'll see if that brings Wolf's margin down or if he wins running away based on the strength of all the TV ads he's been running on the air in Pennsylvania since February.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Steve Shepard. Steve Shepard is a campaigns and elections editor for Politico.
In recent years, there's been a movement in the food world to buy local, support family farms, and eat more naturally. Our next guest says that's okay as far as it goes, but that we're ignoring a huge part of the story of local food, the reliance on migrant workers, and their well-being.
She says these workers are subject to long hours, low wages, and hazardous working conditions, and if we want the local food movement to succeed in an ethical way, we need to start protecting the workers at the heart of these farming operations.
We're joined now by Margaret Gray. She's an associate professor of political science at Adelphi University. She's the author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. Margaret, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you point out in your book that locavorism, whatever people want to call it, is held up as kind of a virtuous model of sustainable eating. But you say we're missing the story of the workers. Why hasn't that been paid attention to?
You know what? That's a great question. I think the main answer to why we've paid attention to the environment, why we've paid attention to the way animals are treated and to the plight of small farmers is that when it comes to the labor conditions, this is seen as actually challenging the farmers themselves. But I think the other side of it is that for the most part, what you read about the local food movement and what you read about the production processes, it's very romanticized. And I think we're often given the impression that these are teeny tiny farms, they maybe don't even have any workers. But I think given that we're told that almost everything else is better on smaller local farms, that we're also, it's easy to jump to the conclusion that working conditions are better as well. So I think there's two parts, our own romance with farms and the way that food writing has primed us to think that way.
So as you point out, just because a farm is small, just because it's a family farm, doesn't mean they don't have farm laborers. What you focused on the Hudson River Valley, but I think this is similar to places around the country. What were working conditions like for these farm workers?
Sure. So the first thing that I think listeners should keep in mind is that farm workers in most of the country do not have a right to overtime pay. They don't have a right to a day of rest, and they don't have collective bargaining protections. So, you know, I've met workers who are working 70, 80, 90-hour work weeks, and not just for 2 weeks of peak harvest, but repeatedly long hours and just getting paid straight minimum wage. So part of it is the law itself creates an opportunity for these workers to be exploited. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of farm workers are non-citizen workers, and they're afraid to complain. So they often don't want to say, hey, we're working too fast, or it's really too hot out, or are you sure that my paycheck is paid correctly? So part of it is also their own fear, and their fear to a certain extent is that they're going to lose their jobs, that they're going to be deported. But they've also heard other stories about workers getting fired for asking questions like this. So that's another part of it. And, you know, you can ask any farmer. Farm work itself is difficult work. It's all manual labor. And especially on, you know, Hudson Valley diversified farms, you don't have mechanization. So we're talking about all hand labor here.
And you talk to a lot of the farm workers, some of them undocumented immigrants, some guest workers. What did they tell you about why they did these jobs despite low pay, despite these tough working conditions?
It's a pretty old immigrant story that they just don't have the same opportunity in their home countries. And so that's why they're here. They want to provide for their families. They want to put in a real floor in their home. They want to have indoor plumbing. They want to pay for medical bills. They want to send their kids to school. So in that sense, it's a sort of old story. They're also just acutely aware. So many of them have just a grade school education, and they don't have English language skills. And so there are very few jobs they feel are open to them, and farm work is one of the jobs that is open to them.
And you point out that often these farm workers might be provided with lodging while they work on a farm, or maybe food or other perks like that, but that comes, you say, with a downside. What is that?
Yeah, so I call this the price of proximity. So on the one hand, the proximity we have as consumers to local food is something we really enjoy. We get fresh food, they taste better, and we get to buy it not in a corporate grocery store. The flip side of that is that there's a price of proximity for these workers who are living on the farms. So as soon as your boss is in charge of some aspect of your life outside of work, that's a recipe for a paternalistic relationship to develop. And what happens with paternalism is that workers get housing, they might be able to take food from the farm, they might be able to use farm vehicles, maybe the farmer does them little favors to help them out. And I have talked to plenty of farmers, and I think that they often are doing this to be generous, that they want to help the workers. But the flip side is that the workers feel that they better behave really well in order to maintain those benefits. And so there are different layers of those benefits. And the more extensive the benefits, the more that they act as a form of labor control, because workers are interested in continuing to secure those benefits.
So you're not, well, not only is your job at risk, but maybe your home is at risk then.
Yes, exactly.
We just have a couple minutes, and I want to get to the consumer side. You point out the irony that there's a growing trend, some people maybe in the local food movement, asking how an animal was raised before they eat it, but not asking how the workers who raise that animal or the other foodstuffs are treated.
Yes, so, you know, I'm talking about a food ethic, and I take that directly from food writers like Michael Pollan. And I think when consumers want to know that the animals were treated well, it's about a food ethic. And so the same way that we've primed consumers to say, hey, ask questions about how much space these animals have, ask questions about the pesticide use. Nobody up until now has been priming us to ask questions about workers. So I think, you know, I think this is the natural next step for the food movement to really embrace working conditions, improving them.
And does this all boil down to, even if we want local food, we want it to be cheap? There's this pressure on the farmer, and what do we do about that?
So, you know, yes, I think this is definitely part of a much greater conversation about how cheap our food is in this country. But there's an agricultural economist, Philip Martin, at UC Davis, and what he showed is that if you increased farm worker wages by 40%, it would only cost the American consumer about $16 a year. And you also have the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, and they had a penny per pound of tomato increase, and that penny per pound increase has led to a substantial substantial improvement in farm worker wages for those tomato workers. So, yes, I think consumers are going to have to pay more, but it's probably not the same dramatic increase that we expect if that money gets passed directly to the workers.
Margaret, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
We've been talking to Margaret Gray. She's an associate professor of political science at Adelphi University. Her new book is called Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic.